Prior to investing, please read the investment's prospectus carefully. The prospectus contains information about the investment, including the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Orders for the purchase or sale of securities or other investment products cannot be accepted by email. The information contained in this communication is not tax, accounting, or regulatory advice. Please consult your advisor as to any tax, accounting, or legal statements made herein. Subject to applicable law, all electronic communications are monitored, reviewed, and electronically archived and may be subject to review and or disclosure to third parties in certain circumstances. The views and opinions expressed herein do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of SCF Securities, Inc. or any SCF-related entity. Women face many financial decisions throughout their lives. You may be getting married or divorced, changing careers, or getting ready to retire. There are also plans that need to be made for family and loss of a spouse or other loved ones. Welcome to Women Be Wise, helping women gain financial empowerment. Your host is Darlene Gilmore. In our show, we'll give you some proven advice designed to assist you with these financial decisions. Now, here is Darlene.
Good morning and welcome back to Women Be Wise. I am so excited for the guests that we have with us today. We have Janice L. Green, attorney at law, and she's been an attorney for 35 plus years working as a family law attorney. She's board certified in family law in Texas, and she also is a litigator in complex divorces and modifications, and she devotes her practice now to using a collaborative process to resolve divorce, premarital, and postmarital agreements and parent-child modifications. She's the author of Divorce After 50, Your Guide to the Unique Legal and Financial Challenges. And that reflects what her real goal is all about. Good morning, Janice, and thank you so much for being on our program.
Well, thank you for asking me.
So this is a wonderful topic. Obviously, we have a huge group of baby boomers out there, and I imagine you're seeing more and more late-life divorces. Is that true?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So I was so much
there's even been some research that has tracked the increase in late-life divorces that has come out of Bowling Green University, that the number of over 50 divorcing doubled between 1990 and 2010. So, Yes.
Wow, that was one of the questions I had was there really a higher percentage just because it's a larger group, but apparently there are.
Yeah, and certainly the fact that you have the numbers of the boomer generation moving through the population contributes to that, and certainly the attitudes that the boomer generation reflects is part of that trend as well.
So there's a lot of different reasons reading your book that kind of surprised me in terms of why people get divorced, and probably the one that surprised me the most was because of health issues, either because one of the spouses has Alzheimer's and that person's thinking about quality of life down the road, or that individual themselves may have a terminal illness and they are thinking about, I don't want to be stuck here. I want to go enjoy life. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes. I mean, it's not so much a phenomenon just with the over 50 crowd, but certainly health issues become more common and more frequently encountered after 50 and on into the 60s, 70s, and 80s and on up. And it's amazing how people really go through a reevaluation of what their life's priorities are. And if they think and find themselves in a very unhappy marital situation, I have seen them definitely question their marriages and many times file for divorce to change their course, so to speak. And I mentioned in the book as well, there was this fascinating piece of research that came out of a couple of Western U.S. medical schools that looked at patients who had been diagnosed with very serious illnesses. And they decided to just look at the marital relationships in those patients' lives. And these were diseases like cancer or Alzheimer's or MLS, I mean, very serious prognosis. And the researchers found that when the women were the patients. Their marriages were six times more likely to fail after the diagnosis, which was it kind of startled the people who were running the study that there was such a disparity between the male and female response to that kind of diagnosis and the effect it had on their marriages. So anyway, the point is that, yes, people do evaluate their marriages and in those kinds of health crises.
So I'm thinking probably those numbers were that startling because women are typically the caretakers.
Men are used
to doing that, you think?
Right, right. And sometimes even, for example, though, with my experience with Alzheimer's is that often if the wife is the one who initiated the divorce, they have, in several cases that I've handled in this regard, they have continued as a caretaker after the divorce. They have, but it's a more limited caretaking role. It's not as obviously full-time as it would have been if they had remained married. But they still are tied in a lot of ways to that former spouse and still exercising those caretaker tendencies, shall we say.
So, and in one of the cases, you indicated that the wife got the divorce just because the husband, after being diagnosed with Alzheimer's, became somewhat abusive.
Yes, he was abusive before the diagnosis, and then it increased after the diagnosis. But at least she, obviously, after the diagnosis, she knew a little bit about what was going on and what was happening. But he was, at the time that he had not yet moved into any kind of, you know, 24/7 caretaking facility for Alzheimer's patients, she found it impossible to live with him because of his abusive nature that may have been accentuated by the disease or, you know, may have had elements before the disease. But she just, with her own sense of personal safety, she could not live under the same roof with him. And but she did continue to stay in touch with and, still continued contact with her spouse, her former spouse, after the divorce. But, yes, it was the level of abuse that led to just she couldn't handle it anymore and really had no other choice other than to get out of the marriage.
And another reason, I hate to keep talking about Alzheimer's, but in your book you mentioned it was a financial reason. I think it was the husband that had to reevaluate because with Alzheimer's, you're physically healthy most times.
Yes.
And you can live a really long time and deplete the assets. And so that person decided it would be better economically to divorce, even though they may still be taking care of them.
Right, right. That's exactly right. Sometimes those financial decisions, and I've had a case involving Alzheimer's where both parties understood the nature of the disease and the costs, et cetera, and the patient was really the one who initiated divorcing to try to preserve some estate, more estate for his wife.
Okay. Well, that's good. And under those circumstances, I'm not sure if you know this answer, does that eliminate the IRS doing that 5-year look back rule?
No, I do not believe it does. It doesn't eliminate it.
Okay. So just because you get divorced, it still would have to deal with that issue.
I think that that would be a possibility for sure.
Okay. Another reason that, excuse me, that you put in the book was that gender equality has made it easier for women to express their dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. On my first program, I talked about how it's flipped in many ways, that many times the women are making more income than the men in the households. The women are the ones out working. The men are becoming house husbands and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Do you see a lot of that making a major impact on this divorce situation?
Yes, and I think that one of the major things is one, that sense of empowerment that comes with a degree of financial independence, so sort of fuses into other aspects of your life, such as whether you want to stay in a marriage that is emotionally unsatisfactory to you. But in addition to that, you certainly have the freedom or the sense of, gee, I will survive after this divorce because I, as a woman in this case, have that financial independence. And one of the things that was interesting back in 2004, AARP did a study and a survey of people over, I think that they were definitely over 50. They may have had the cutoff at 60, but they were looking at one of the first studies to look at late life divorce. And surprisingly enough, the women were more often the filer of the divorce. And one of the reasons had to do with addictive behavior in their spouse that they were no longer able to tolerate. And plus, when they had some sense of financial independence, that also drove their decision to get a divorce as well. So you have certainly financial considerations of what you can and cannot have and do and afford after a divorce leads people to, you know, stay in the marriages or not.
I was surprised as well about reading about people getting divorced in their 80s. Yeah. I was so surprised with that. I always thought probably it occurred when they became empty nesters or, you know, they retire and now they're having a lot of time together and discovering that they've grown apart. But they have a lot of those occur in their late ages.
Mm-hmm.
Is that mostly health related probably?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's just health related. It was interesting that I think Bowling Green, back to their study about looking at the statistics, so to speak, of the late life divorce, they picked up on the over age 65 group even exceeded that doubling of the incidence of divorce that I mentioned a moment ago that they found
right.
between they found in the overall over 50 category. When the people were over 65, they found the incidence was more than that doubling figure. And they found that 55% of those divorces involved couples who were married longer than 20 years.
Wow.
So I think that, you know, it's hard to tease out what all the issues are, but one of the things that I have encountered, and this is just anecdotal, in these 80-year-old divorces is that people have married after, whether it's a prior marriage that they're divorcing or whether it is due to a death of a spouse, but they will remarry quickly, and then they find themselves in maybe they made a mistake scenario.
Okay.
And they are divorcing in their 80s because they realize that that the relationship they had with this subsequent spouse is in no way what they thought it was going to be. And it wasn't so much health-driven in the situations that I've seen.
Yeah, I forgot about that. You did mention in the book about how much quicker a person will divorce the second or third time.
Yes, the incidence of the divorce really goes up in marriages 2, 3, and 4. Yeah.
I think because after you've done it once, it's sort of like, oh, well, that wasn't real hard.
Right.
So
that's
I can,
right.
And
that's
I'm
right.
not going to put up with
that,
this for 20 years,
you know,
this time.
I'm seeing signs here that I didn't see in the, you know, romantic fog. And I'm going to make a decision much quicker again, because I know there are fewer years ahead of me than behind me. And that
yeah.
sense of mortality drives that quickness of decision a lot of times.
Yeah, I think we all have known that those second and third marriages don't last as long, or they're quicker to get divorced in those situations.
Right.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. We've got Janice Green, attorney at law. Please feel free to call in with your questions.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Darlene Gilmore has been in the financial industry for over 3 decades, helping individuals reach their financial goals. As a certified financial planner professional and a certified divorce financial analyst, she can help identify and develop a strategy to help you through the critical financial events you may experience. Call her at 512-302-5534 or visit AustinWealthSpecialists.com. When your values are clear, your decisions are easy. Again, visit AustinWealthSpecialists.com or call Darlene today at 512-302-5534.
Game-changing technologies and strategies are transformational, exciting, and disruptive for a reason. They shake up your status quo. They get you thinking about new ways to scale, compete, and grow. They move you in amazing new directions. You're invited to Take Your Coffee Break with Game Changers on Thursdays at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time for our special series on the future of business. Learn how you can become the transformational leader who takes your company across the finish line as you look ahead to the next breakthrough wave of innovation. The Future of Business with Game Changers, presented by SAP on the Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Women Be Wise, helping women gain financial empowerment. To reach Darlene Gilmore or her guest today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to Darlene at women-b-wise.com. And remember, it's the letter B. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome back. We have our guest with us, Janice Green, attorney at law, and we're talking about the challenges for divorce after 50. Janice, one of the things I thought about while we were gone is perhaps divorces are easier when it's after 50 because now they're empty nesters. Many people don't get divorces because of the children.
Yes.
Is that part of the reason it happens so more later in life?
Yes, that's definitely can be a factor, and particularly when the parents, the spouses have been so focused on raising their children, and that's been the common, you know, glue in their relationship. And then once the kids are launched, you know, they're looking at each other going, who are you? Who are you?
Right.
So, yes, that's one reason. And another thing that kind of goes along with that empty nester is that if you, particularly if soon after the kids are gone, when you've got the retirement situation where you have one or both people retiring, you have again that facing each other and wondering what do you have in common and whether you've grown apart so much during your marriage that, you know, you end up heading toward the divorce track.
And I think also the children may give them permission. I know that's what happened in my family. My parents were not getting divorced. We were out of the house. And I'm saying, what are you guys doing? Why don't you just go your separate ways? And they kind of looked at me very strange, surprised that I said that. But sometimes I think they need that validation that it's okay.
Yeah. In adult children, you raise an interesting issue, and I'm going to kind of take off on it for a moment, but adult children are affected as much, you know, differently in some ways, but are affected as much by their parents' later life divorce than sometimes the younger children are. And they can become, the adult children, can be very actively involved in their parents' divorce. Certainly they may have a financial interest in, oh my God, there have been promises made about helping the adult child financially that may not be able to be carried out once a divorce reduces the family to two separate households rather than just one. So there are all sorts of issues, and I go into this in some depth, but there are all sorts of issues surrounding the relationship of adult children to their divorcing parents.
What impact, has the no-fault divorces had on the increase of divorces out there?
Well, whether you're over 50 or under 50, the no-fault divorce has definitely contributed to destigmatizing, so to speak, the idea of getting divorced. And essentially what no-fault divorce means is that when you file for divorce, you can state the grounds as being something like incompatibility or insupportability, and it's called different things in different states. And those can be the grounds rather than the way it used to be when you had to prove adultery or you had to prove cruelty, which are sort of those mudslinging grounds. And while those mudslinging grounds may still be on the books, most people use the no-fault divorce. And what that comes down to is just a statement that the marriage is no longer supportable. The relationship has deteriorated to the point that there's no hope for reconciliation or no likelihood of reconciliation. And it just takes one person, one spouse, to claim that the marriage is insupportable. And there will be a divorce. You don't contest whether there will be a divorce because it just takes one spouse to make those grounds, and then there will be a divorce. The issues becoming contested then are property division, you know, child issues, whatever. But because it has allowed people to end their marriages without getting into the mudslinging and has allowed sort of a unilateral decision to end the marriage, the concept of no fault has certainly contributed to the increase in divorces.
It also helps financially, doesn't it? Because they don't have to spend as much money with private detectives and all this other thing to prove their case.
Definitely. Definitely.
So it's to everyone's best interest to kind of let that go, and that helps.
In most cases, yes. In most cases.
Do you see if a lot of people decide they want to do a trial run before they get married, and they're saying the purpose is to make sure they've chosen the right person, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have the background information on marriages, on how long they lived together or stayed together before they decided to get married.
Mm-hmm.
What would you guess? Is there any difference, really?
I'm not sure that there is much difference. And I don't recall the specifics, but I know that there are some studies out there of do marriages last longer when the spouses live together, you know, for X period of time. I vaguely recall that there isn't much difference, but you know, I don't know the answer to that, and it certainly would be fun to find out.
Right. I know a couple of personal examples where they lived together for 4 and 5 years, and then when they got married, it didn't last at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because their whole mindset changed.
Mm-hmm.
Once they got married. There was this level of ownership or something that was there that changed. So I was just curious about that.
Uh-huh.
So let's change and go a little bit into the actual process. First thing is, how do you find the attorney, or how do you decide what approach to use when you're wanting to get divorced?
Well, the first thing as far as finding an attorney, you know, talking with people, because we all know people who have gone through divorce, and maybe getting a referral through friends or family, or if you know an attorney, even though they may not be a family law person or practitioner, the community of attorneys usually have a good referral network and stay aware of expertise in areas of practice other than their own. So one of the best ways to get a referral is through an attorney, friend, family member. Another way is to do research on the internet, to look at some of the credentials of the attorneys who practice family law in your area. And I certainly recommend that you look for someone who, depending upon the state, whether there is board certification for family law, if there is such a thing as certification in your case, certainly I would recommend gravitating toward at least that initial consultation, being with someone who has special skills in family law and has practiced long, is familiar with the judges in your area, your geographical area, and has some expertise and can talk with some authority from experience. I mean, there's nothing like experience in the trenches. So I think certainly word of mouth, and then taking those recommendations and looking at what their background is and what kind of membership or honors or whether they do any kind of writing or lecturing or appeal work, you know, just do your research on them.
One of the things I find that is difficult for people to do, even in my industry, is to actually interview this expert to make sure there's a good fit.
Yes.
And one of the things that kind of surprised me in your book was if that first appointment is complimentary, then there's no client attorney privilege. So
there
I guess on the
not.
Interview, you need to make sure that you're not getting into detail. You're just there to determine, is this the attorney you want to work with?
Right. And one of the things that is sort of behind, at least certainly in Texas, but is behind the charging for those initial consultations is that it does establish an attorney-client relationship for that meeting. It doesn't mean that you have to retain that attorney for the long haul, but that you have as the potential client, when you go in and you talk to an attorney, it's going to be very hard not to get into the facts of your case. I mean, that's
right.
Just next to impossible because you're wanting some guidance from that attorney or some thinking and expertise from them as to, as to what the likelihood of certain outcomes in your case. And it's very easy to get into that kind of a discussion in those initial consultations. So one of the reasons that often attorneys will charge is that it makes it very clear that that communication, that office conference is protected by attorney-client privilege. And that means that that attorney that you may have met with only once cannot turn around and be hired by your spouse.
Oh, that's a good point.
And that sort of knocks them out of, being involved in the case, which is, again, another reason that attorneys will charge for that initial consultation. But I strongly recommend that people lawyer shop. And by that, I mean talk to more than one attorney. First of all, you're going to learn things that are different, from different attorneys. You're going to have a better idea of how to size up their personality and what kind of a match you have, and you have some point of comparison among them. And I think it's always wise to at least interview two or three. And while, yes, you are paying each time you talk to those attorneys for the most part, you are increasing your chances of being satisfied with whomever you decide to go with.
And you mentioned just simple things. Do they return phone calls? Do they respond to your emails promptly?
Right.
So you may want to just almost do a test after you have the interview, follow up with an email or a phone call to find out if they are responsive to you.
Right, right. And most people are pretty aware and intuitive that when you're sitting down talking to someone, if all they're doing is talking about themselves, they're not asking you about your situation, they're trying to impress you with who they may have represented in the past or the size of cases and whether their ego is so big that, they probably wouldn't give your case much time. I mean, there are all sorts of subtle things you can pick up about people. And just asking them questions about their experience and how they would approach certain things and how they do business and how they bill and how they, how they approach negotiations. So I think those initial screenings, if anything, are really an important thing to do. So I encourage lawyer shopping to say okay. it mildly.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the different avenues that can be used to get divorced. You specialize in the collaborative law. So we'll talk about some of the different options that are available. We'll go to break right now. We'll be right back.
Okay.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Darlene Gilmore has been in the financial industry for over three decades, helping individuals reach their financial goals. As a certified financial planner professional and a certified divorce financial analyst, she can help identify and develop a strategy to help you through the critical financial events you may experience. Call her at 512-302-5534 or visit AustinWealthSpecialists.com. When your values are clear, your decisions are easy. Again, visit AustinWealthSpecialists.com or call Darlene today at 512-302-5534. Social media is growing at an astounding rate. In just virtually 5 short years, we have seen YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter take the world by storm. How do you effectively make social media work for you? Tune in to The Social Universe with host Kurt Wilhelm. We'll show you how to market your business or yourself to get ahead, especially in unstable economic times. We'll also discuss practices that you can apply to increase visibility and revenue as you unlock the mysteries of the social universe. The Social Universe is broadcast live every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Women Be Wise, helping women gain financial empowerment. To reach Darlene Gilmore or her guests today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to Darlene at women-b-wise.com. And remember, it's the letter B. Now, back to this week's program.
Okay. Here we are with Janice Green, attorney at law, and we're talking about late life divorces or graying divorces. We are going to now talk about some of the options that are available to you if you find yourself needing to or wanting to have a divorce. I think oftentimes we think it's going to cost a lot of money, Janice, isn't that true? But we've got some ways that can help reduce the cost, especially
yes.
if there's not a lot of antagonism going on.
Right. The sort of to kind of give an overview of the different kind of options that people have, you start off with litigation, which is sort of the traditional approach to divorce, meaning that you always have the hammer, so to speak, of going to the courthouse to resolve differences, or the option of having hearings or having a trial to determine whether, you know, whether the outcome is going to be one way or the other. It's basically put in another person's hands, in the judge's lap. And the trend in the last probably 15 or so years or longer has been to examine alternative ways of approaching divorce. And one of those is certainly mediation, which can be used along with both litigation and collaboration. And I'll come back to collaborative family law in a minute. But mediation is simply a method of negotiating where you bring in a third-party mediator who guides the parties in an attempt to reach an agreement. The mediator is usually not the person who is tasked with coming up with a resolution or making a decision or a ruling or deciding the fate. They are simply a facilitator to get the two people to communicating and to settle their case. And then there's collaborative family law, which is sort of the newer kid on the block, even though we've had a statute in Texas for almost 15 years dealing with collaborative. And it is a more structured approach. In this state and in a lot of states, collaborative requires that each party, each spouse, be represented by an attorney. And it certainly is important that each one of those attorneys is trained in collaborative family law, because the negotiating skills that are used in collaborative law are in many ways a different skill set from litigation skills. And in the collaborative process, you can call it many things, but there is usually a series of joint meetings where both parties and both attorneys are sitting down in meetings that have specific agendas so that there's no element of surprise, and there are minutes of those meetings. And there may be other team members in the collaborative process, such as neutral mental health professionals who serve as moderators for those joint meetings. Also, there may be neutral financial experts, such as financial planners such as you, or there may be a CPA brought in, again, to serve as someone who, that an independent financial person usually is in charge of the spreadsheet of assets and is the one who is gathering some of the financial information and helping people work through some of the financial decisions. So and then you work through the case as you do in litigation, but it's around the table. You have full disclosure, and it is bound by contract to be, you know, upfront anything that anybody needs and wants by way of financial documents, let's say, you're going to get them. You're not going to be playing games at the courthouse and keeping those away from the other party. And then you work toward an agreement, and it's a very structured, it's interest-based negotiations, and it can be structured, and it's much less adversarial, but you do still have that attorney-client relationship with your attorney. You're just being much more civil about it, let's say. And in most states that have collaborative, the attorneys, should a spouse decide to go into litigation and let a judge decide, you know, make a ruling, then you can stop the collaborative process and move into litigation. But when you do, the collaborative attorneys cannot represent you in the litigation. So that's
so you'd have to get a different attorney.
Pardon me?
You'd have to get a different attorney.
That's
if
right.
You
would have to get litigation counsel. And it's not that everything that happens in collab is not usable if the case bounces back into litigation, but that is, you know, a factor that keeps people at the table, that they don't want to switch attorneys. But the reason for that is that it increases the level of comfort that people have and the ability to negotiate easier, better. When the attorneys there sitting at the table, you know, are not going to be the ones who would cross-examine you if you went to the courthouse.
Do you find that the collaborative approach is less time-consuming than litigation?
It depends. It's more time-consuming for the clients, in a sense, because they are much more actively involved in their case. I think that's one way of putting it. There's less money spent on fighting about certain issues. I mean, and certainly going to the courthouse, every time you go and you have delays and you may be reached for a hearing one day and maybe not, you have your time and the attorney's time much more focused, which I think contributes to the lower cost on the most part of collaborative divorces. That's not to say that they're always cheaper than litigation, but for the most part, that's what happens, is that you save money and you certainly preserve a sense of relationship with the other person after the divorce, whether it be, you know, just simply a friend, or if they're children, minor children, you may have a better co-parenting relationship. But also collaborative is very helpful when you're dealing with older people who have a greater, sometimes, level of anxiety in going, you know, in preparing for the courthouse and dealing with all of those unknowns. So I find collaborative to be very, you know, often used in the late life divorce, as long as, you know, both people are comfortable with it, there's not a history of abuse or there's not active substance abuse or addiction or active mental illness. Those are the kinds of scenarios that dissuade someone from going down the collaborative path.
Okay. Now, you'd also mentioned arbitration.
Yes.
What is the difference there?
Well, arbitration is like litigation, only you are choosing your judge. You are paying, usually independently, for that person to serve as a judge. Some states limit arbitrators to be those who are attorneys and are particularly licensed, or they may be retired judges. But you have usually the same kind of rules of evidence and needs for hearing. It's just who is making the decision is different from litigation.
Oh, okay. Can you get into the fee structures and which ones to be cautious about, and how do you interview to make sure you're not going to be caught up in, and even how do you decide that maybe the spouse is going to pay for the legal fees?
Right, right. The, you know, you're either going to pay a flat fee or you're going to pay an hourly fee. And you're going to have a retainer or no retainer. And let me start with the first, flat fee versus hourly. I have rarely known of good family lawyers who charge a flat fee, and the reason is because it is next to impossible to predict exactly how much time a case is going to take, and because complexities and information comes bubbling to the surface well into the case that can change the course of it or how much time the attorney needs to spend on it and how complex it is or isn't. So that's number one. And a flat fee, it's very difficult to predict. And flat fees have an element of prediction. And you may, as the client, end up paying more than you needed to with the flat fee. Or you may be paying less, but you don't have the attention of that attorney because they're, you know, it's just human nature to put at the bottom of your work stack those cases where you've already gone through the money of that flat fee and you're working for free maybe for months to come. And that's when phone calls don't get returned and et cetera. So I always consider it a lose-lose situation for people to go down the flat fee route. Now, if it's a very, very simple divorce, no real estate, no kids, and it's just extremely simple and straightforward, then that may be more of an option. Hourly rates vary according to the expertise of a client, I mean expertise of an attorney. Also, some attorneys charge by and break up their time charges by a quarter of an hour, some by tenth of an hour, and certainly the tenth of an hour is better for the client. Retainers are like a deposit down on the future fees, and attorneys set their retainers based upon what their anticipated complexities are of the case. And some attorneys charge a larger retainer up front and then bill against it over a period of months. Some attorneys charge a lower retainer, and it's called an evergreen retainer, where you maintain a certain balance each month. And the idea behind retainers is that, for the most part, once your case is completed or your relationship with that attorney has terminated, then if there's any money left in your retainer account, then that should be refunded to you. That's why it's so important that your attorney keep billing you periodically. So there are few surprises, and you know, and you can monitor what your case is costing.
And I was always worried when I called the attorney about the clock ticking.
Yes.
And I found myself not calling and asking certain questions because I was worried about running up my bill.
Yeah. I mean, and that's with any service that charges by time, whether it's, you know, the plumber or whatever, you've got that concern. But I think that, you know, one of the things that some attorneys do is they may keep their time. And I know this is something that I do, and it's what I do is I sort of interject discretionary value billing into my monthly billing. And I will write down the time it takes me to do something, but I will also note there may be days, you know, that I am distracted, or maybe I have a bad case of allergies and I'm not moving as quickly or thinking as quickly, or there are all sorts of reasons why an expenditure of a half an hour one day might stretch into, you know, a 45 minutes on another day. So I will reduce sometimes, often actually, on my billings and note them as no charge. But that's where I reduce the amount of time or no charge for the time based upon all sorts of factors.
And we're going to go to break again, okay, and we'll come back for our last little talk with Janice Green, attorney at law.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Darlene Gilmore has been in the financial industry for over three decades, helping individuals reach their financial goals. As a certified financial planner professional and a certified divorce financial analyst, she can help identify and develop a strategy to help you through the critical financial events you may experience. Call her at 512-302-5534 or visit AustinWealthSpecialists.com. When your values are clear, your decisions are easy. Again, visit AustinWealthSpecialists.com or call Darlene today at 512-302-5534.
Great leaders today have certain capabilities that set them apart. These leaders have discovered transformational leadership. Now, you can discover the same ideas, insights, and programs that have led them to success. Inside Transformational Leadership, hosted by Kate Ebner, is produced by Georgetown University's Institute for Transformational Leadership. We'll explore these stories and concepts every Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Women Be Wise, helping women gain financial empowerment. To reach Darlene Gilmore or her guest today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to Darlene at women-b-wise.com. And remember, it's the letter B. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome back again. Again, we're talking with Janice Green, attorney at law. Janice, I think we'll end this segment by talking about a very public divorce with the Mr. Harold Hamm and his ex-wife, Ms. Arnold. There are many issues that come up in dividing up assets, especially those of a business. Yeah. What would you caution women about in property division?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that the property division, whether it is through agreement or whether it's through litigation, is value plays, the value of an asset or all the assets is sort of the measuring stick that the judges use in determining the division. So valuing your assets is extremely important. And as you can see, that happened in the Hamm case, is that the value of an asset can change drastically through the course of the divorce and certainly during an appeal, such as, you know, the drop in value of his stock in the appellate court. So One of the things that I think is so important for women to keep in mind about property divisions is that it's very easy to get caught up in what I call these kitchen table negotiations and to reach an agreement too early in the case. And unless you have a really simple estate and you don't need any appraisals or you don't need any business valuations, if you reach an agreement and you really aren't informed about the value and all the aspects of value to your assets, then it's not that you're going to be held to that kitchen table agreement, but it's going to make it tougher to negotiate a settlement if you choose to back off of it. It will just be more costly, more time, you know, take up more time. So I always caution people to try to abstain from negotiating too early, because you can have to spend a lot of time later on digging yourself out of the expectations that you set up with that initial agreement. And I think it's so important, and it can affect the cost of your case, is that if you don't know what you have, and this happens a lot, that people, and still, it still happens, and it's the women who have been focused on running the home and raising the children, and they really, their role has not been involved with day-to-day knowledge of assets and liabilities. And I think it's very important. Start looking at the mail. Start looking at your tax return, studying it. Start trying to figure out what is there? What do we own? And just so that you can at least, should you end up in a divorce scenario, that you can give information to your attorney that will help uncover and be sure that all assets have been discussed.
I think that's one of the advantages, and I'm going to plug a certified divorce financial analyst, since I am one, to get them involved.
Oh, yes.
Because they will look at all of those assets, and unlike a CPA who just looks at what the value is right now, mm-hmm. we are looking at what will that create for retirement income, et cetera, down the road. So we're better helping them to make more of an equitable decision about
it. That's right. And what's tied into that as well is working with financial planners or working to find out as best that you can estimate what are your living expenses likely to be on the other side of divorce.
Right.
And what resources are going to, what assets should you negotiate for that will produce the kind of income or produce the kind of growth potential or give you a mixed portfolio so that you can meet what life is starting to look like on the other side of divorce? Because, and it's very hard to get people to sit down and do those expenses budget analyses. It's a dreaded part of divorce, but you'll do it in any divorce, and the sooner the better, because it's such an important guide and gives you such important information for your negotiations.
And
the other thing, too, is this idea of putting all your eggs in one basket, where you decide, oh, I've got to have this house. I want to keep this house. He can have that retirement. I am so tied. I don't want to leave. I don't want to move. I don't want to downsize. And you have this emotional tie to the home. And it may or may not be wise for you to keep that home. It may be better for you to have part of the equity in the home and part of the retirement. You know, back to that mixed portfolio thing that the financial advisors will help you come up with.
As well, you keep the home, you also keep the expenses, the taxes,
exactly.
The maintenance, and a lot of that, they don't know how to factor that in.
Exactly.
And the retirement, you know, they've got the best of the assets, actually, when you think about it down the road.
Right.
But I've also seen a case of the opposite,
yes.
where someone took the retirement, needed the cash, and didn't realize all the tax implications
uh-huh.
of getting that. They thought, I have this big pot of cash, but they didn't really because of the taxes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you end up in the situation where your spouse is going to owe you money or pay you money at the end of divorce, on the other side of it, whether you call it alimony or whether it's a property buyout, for heaven's sakes, be sure that it is as best that you can. And sometimes you can't get collateral, but you want to have collateral. You want to have some security behind that promise to pay. And that's where later in life, life insurance can be a very important factor in resolving divorce cases. And being a, you know, it can be a chit on the table that can be used in the settlement of the property division. Whether it's life insurance or disability insurance, there are several factors with estate planning that can become part of the negotiations for the property division as well. So there are lots of different things on the table that you can use to drive a really good resolution to your divorce, as good as possible.
Good. So let's talk about this one last point as we come to a close, that listening to everybody's stories about what to do and not to do and trying to incorporate all that with what your attorney is doing can get very confusing.
And certainly I have heard of, I have seen attorneys giving bad advice. So that compounds it even more when people become suspicious of or untrusting of their attorneys, which takes us back to my original, an early point of you've got to have trust in who you're working with, and that's an important thing to look for when you're finding the attorney. But everybody has some experience with divorce, whether it's a family member or a friend, and everybody has an opinion about what you should do or should not bargain for or not take less than that, and gee, this is not fair or that's not fair. Often, you know, fairness doesn't necessarily enter into it, and that's a hard thing to get to grasp, but usually the test is what is equitable, and they're not necessarily the same. But one of the things that can happen, and I've had this happen on numerous occasions, where a client was really listening to some family member or some, you know, advisor out there not to settle for anything less than X, and that stuck in my client's mind so much that they wouldn't pay attention to the fact that that is not the way the case is going to be resolved. There's no way that is going to happen.
So we'll have to end on that point. We're coming to a close. Thank you so much, Janice, for being on the air. I think we're going to have you back because we've got so many issues that we didn't touch on.
That's right.
Next week, we're going to talk about protecting your assets through various forms of insurances, long-term care, life insurance. So be sure to tune in for next week, and we'll learn how to protect your assets as well. Have a great day, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Women Be Wise, helping women gain financial empowerment. Be sure to join Darlene Gilmore again next Thursday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a super week.